Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
Yanis, thank you so much for finding time joining us on the Ivy Podcast. Very excited about this conversation. I know you have a wealth of experience that you're going to share with us today. Before we jump in and talk about your all of the great things in AI investing and just overall what we want to chat about, give us a little bit of a breakdown of your background, your story, and just a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, John. So thank you so much for having me. It's actually fascinating when I get to discuss with like-minded people like yourself, and especially when you come from the investment side. That is always interesting in an innovation cycle that like the one that we are undergoing. But as you said, let me give you a bit of background. I tend to joke and say that I'm the guy that was not supposed to be here, and that's kind of like a very constant trend throughout my career. I guess I'm this little kid with big dreams. I was born and raised in Greece. I actually studied there. But once I was done with my MBA in Europe, I decided that I want to become this global citizen and global entrepreneur. I embarked on a global journey some 20-something years ago, first in Europe for about a decade, where I worked with large global organizations like Procter & Gamble and one of the largest luxury groups in the world, Richemont, because I had this perception, which proved to be not exactly accurate, that the big companies do it in a way that then you learn and you go out and you build your own companies. That was kind of like my early young inspiration. The reality is pretty far from that. But I personally got very lucky because I had some great people I worked with and worked for. I had some great roles. And very quickly, my early 30s, I ended up being the regional CEO for one of the luxury brands in Northern Europe. So I was based in Amsterdam. I had done a tour between France, Switzerland, and the Netherlands. And I was like, I had made it. Like it felt great. I had this beautiful big office, the expensive car, like the big salaries. But I was very unhappy because I'm truly an entrepreneur. And it's interesting that we're having this conversation because one would ask, why AI? So I had actually embarked into AI during the dot-com era. So I'm a bit older than what people say I look. I was there in the late 90s, early 2000s, doing research and consulting and research and general like innovation investigation for how we can implement AI into internet experiences, into interactive television experience, and so on. Obviously, at the time, none of that could be implemented due to capacity to we didn't have the computational power, so it was more theoretical than actually the case. But the next 10 years led me back to my roots. So as I told you, I was this very well positioned corporate executive, CEO, GM level, but I was unhappy because I wanted to actually innovate. I wanted to build my own stuff. So I took a personal 90% cost cutting. I moved out of Amsterdam, and with a little stop back to my home country, I started my AI startup in New York. So I moved to New York in 2012, 2013. I started an AI startup when it was not cool to say that you're an AI startup. Nobody would even care. We used to call ourselves a big data startup, eventually machine learning startup. And at the end, we became an AI startup. And I stayed in that early stage entrepreneurial path with AI for the last 14 years. And I've done that in multiple capacities. I've done it as a founder myself. I've done it as an early executive in earlier stage startups. I've done it as a key executive in unicorns and decacorns, and I've done it as an investor, angel investor. I'm an LP in some smaller VCs, and I'm also on my free time, which is not a lot, but I still love doing it. I teach entrepreneurship at NYU, so I have a course that helps graduate students kick off their companies. Usually, they're technical students. And they want to understand the commercial aspect of it. So that's kind of like my journey. I would say my AI journey started, as I said, in the late 90s. I took a break of a decade and then jumped back into it for the last 12, 13 years. So when AI took off in the last couple of years. I was already there. It was very interesting because many people said, how did you know? I'm like, I don't know, maybe luck, maybe life brought me here. But I've been doing AI, GTM, and positioning messaging for some time now.
Well, that's quite a background and there's a lot to unpack. So definitely thank you for sharing that. Tell us a little bit more about your current role. What are you responsible for? And what are some of the challenges that you currently face as you work for a large enterprise?
Yep. So for the last couple of years, for the last few years, and I'm smiling when you say that it's a large enterprise because I work for UiPath. And when I joined UiPath, UiPath was pre-IPO. We actually did a last funding round and then went public while I was there. And in these few years that I've been with UiPath, I've seen it all. I've seen the pre-IPO, post-IPO, challenges with the stock price, upticks of the stock price, market evolution, product evolution, and GTM evolution. So currently, I lead product marketing at UiPath globally, which means that my teams and myself, we are the bridge between product engineering and sales and the customers. We are leading positioning, messaging, and try to drive go-to-market that makes sense at the scale we are. When during my course at UiPath, I've led quite a number of startup categories. So I was the startup guy within the bigger startup or scale up. I would say the diverse jack of all trades when it comes to GTM and taking things to market between product and sales.
Yeah, that's very interesting because it's a very complicated area, especially for startups and early stage companies. We talk about GTM, on daily basis as VCs, as we meet with the founders on, on frequent basis, not only just specifically when they pitch us, but it's just an ongoing conversation because it's a combination of art and the science when it comes to a GTM, the go-to-market strategy that actually works, which requires a lot of pivots, it requires a lot of experimentation. Maybe from your standpoint, as you've built kind of your, from both lens of a startup founder and now also working at a large company like UiPath, leading some of the GTM initiatives as well, share your experience. What are some of the key ingredients that are in your playbook that are must have in every GTM strategy, or maybe some of the do's and don'ts that you could share? With a focus on some of the maybe I guess recommendations for AI founders that are building companies in those early stages.
Yeah, that's a great question, and I will be provocative. I will say that there is a very specific point in time, both for early stage founders, but also for product managers or new initiatives within a larger organization. Call it a new feature, a new line, a new capability, whatever that may be. This is a very similar experience, and it comes very sharp. So I'm being provocative because very quickly, from one day to the next, what you're building is less important if it's not followed by actual customer adoption and or by actual customer purchase leads coming through and eventual adoption. And this thing comes very sharp. So what happens is that in the early days, and that applies to founders, and because we're talking about startups, that applies very much into founders in their first, I would say, year or 18 months or 2 years, depending on what you're building, you're really hands down on building stuff, right? And I will give you some do's and don'ts on how it's best to do that. But you're really into that. Like you're like, okay, I have some assumptions. I have some validation from customers. I think I know what my problem solution fit will be. And you're done building. Very, very quickly, and literally it feels overnight, that changes into, okay, we've built something, we know we're going to pivot no matter what, but now it's all about GTM. It's all about how are we taking these things to market? Who is buying it? Who is our persona? Who is our ideal customer profile, our ICP? Like, how do we make sure that the target group or the segment that we're going after can be either duplicated by parallel segments or it can go by itself so much that it actually gives growth to the company. So I don't know if you use this terminology, but this is where the startup plateau happens. And the startup plateauing generally is that you find your product, your problem solution fit in the beginning, you build something great or something good, you get a few customers through the pipe, and you think you got it. And then eventually you realize that, no, actually these were early adopters. And it doesn't mean that the early success is going to lead you to long-term growth and success. And to avoid that plateau, that's what I call the provocative statement, is if you don't build the right understanding and the right metrics and the right go-to-market to take you from the early successes to a sustainable growth, usually you're going to struggle to get to Series A, where true investment is a bit larger. And even if you get to Series A, because these days, you know, depending on how strong your technology is, it can be faster, you cannot get to Series B. So that Series A, like between seed, Series A and Series B, is that hockey stick moment where you need to move on. So that's kind of like the quick, it was not very quick, but that's kind of like the overarching answer to the question. The do's and the don'ts. One of my favorite don'ts is to, like, most of the startups that die are because, or many of the startups that die from a product perspective is because they think that we will build it and they will come. The old concept of build it and they will come doesn't work. Like, if it does, well, just to be clear, it has worked for some. So if you are this lucky few that it has worked for you because of luck, though, great. Let me invest in your company. I will be very happy to make some money out of it. But in reality, in most cases, it doesn't work. So that's the don't. Don't just build something that you think is cool and you think that you're going to build it and people will come. What you should do instead is really be as customer-centric as you can from day zero. Not day one, day zero. What I mean by that is, typically, and especially with all of the tools that we have today in the AI space, even more so, we can build great things. And I trust founders, especially if they have technical backgrounds, they can build anything, like pretty much anything. So it's not a matter of whether they can build it or not. It's more a matter of what they're going to build. And the what comes from the why, from the pain points of the specific customers they are trying to resolve. So I say that to my counterparts at UiPath, to startup founders. In my class, this is the one thing that you will hear me say the most. Go out and validate your pain points. Start with customer problems. And if you think you know the problems, I will assure you that 50% of your assumptions are wrong. So that's the second don't. Don't assume that you are 100% right. You will be 50% right, 40% right, 60% right. But I can assure you, I can make any bet you want that many of your assumptions or some of your assumptions will not be accurate. And not because you're wrong, but because you will realize that maybe it's not a big enough problem, or you will realize that it is a big enough problem, but not for too many people. So figuring out which part of your assumption is correct and how do you quickly pivot based on interacting with your actual potential customers. And how do you pivot even who they are, who your target segment is, in the early days in particular, is crucial. And once you build your solution, your first MVP, or even your advanced MVP, your first even solution that you take to market, do that again. Go back and understand what is working, what is not working. Talk to your people. Get out of the office and talk to your existing customers, to your prospects, and to segments that you haven't thought of.
Yeah, that's a very complicated space, because at the end of the day, I see a lot with founders in those very early stages where they're so focused on building the technology, so, you know, almost in love with the actual product that they had built. But a lot of times they neglect the importance of really paying attention to your customer needs and the problem that they're actually solving. So there's that balance that, you know, a lot of times founders have to be very, you know, self-aware, I guess, from a standpoint of just really focusing on the true problem you're solving versus being in love with the solution or the product that you had built. You touched upon an important element in terms of defining your ICP, your ideal client persona, which in those early stages that probably evolves on, you know, on daily basis. What are your recommendations when it comes to really trying to narrow down, you know, segment of a segment of a segment, and trying to go as niche as possible to really figure out this is the lowest level of my ICP, and what are some of the indicators that really tell you that this is the right segment, this is something that we need to really focus on at the moment and double down on that? Or also, how do you balance that in the, you know, when you know, you invested so much time, energy, resources, and money to do those experiments, and they turn out to be not quite effective or accurate, and then you have to pivot and start all over again. How do you find that balance? What are some of the tactics maybe that really help you do that efficiently in those early stages?
Yeah, so I will start with the quick answer. You need to find the personas who consider your offering a must-have and not a nice-to-have. So being a must-have is the answer, the simple answer to the question. However, it's not simple at all. It's simple to say, but it's much harder to actually do that. Because when we say that something needs to be a must-have, what does that mean? A must-have means that people are do have a real problem that you are solving for. So that's one dynamic. The second one is that they have budget to actually pay for a solution for that problem. Three, they have the purchasing power to deploy the budget to choose your solution versus anything else. And four, there are many of those people, many of those customers and B2B or B2C that actually make sense for you to go and build against that ICP. So it is as simple as I said it, be a must-have, not a nice-to-have, but very complicated. And the one thing that makes it even more complicated is that you don't have any data when you start. So you need to be very agile in tracking what needs tracking and what matters to confirm that you have that you are must-have and confirm that people are paying for it and confirm that people are using it and confirm that you're not going to lose them with churn a year later. So metrics, data, and making sure that your ICP, you're a must-have for your ICP and they're willing to pay money and they have the money to pay to keep using you. That's kind of like the 5 points I would say secure that at least you have a healthy beginning in your with your company.
How, from your experience, what do you see maybe tools or tactics that really help the founders? And it's also probably kind of on the product management side as well to really figure out, it's very easy to come up with a backlog of features that you should add to your solution, but it's, completely different formula, and it's very difficult to do quite the opposite, where you have to, eliminate the features to make the product as, as simple as possible. So how do you balance that? I see a lot of founders struggle from that standpoint because, it's, here's a huge backlog of everything that we have to build that our customers are asking for, and or at least it seems that they cannot live without certain of those features. Or, when they come to us for funding, they say, well, I need X amount of funding because I need this funding to complete this module. And if I complete this module, my revenue is going to skyrocket. So, and it always boils down to the conversation. How are you capable of doing actually quite the opposite, not building on your backlog, but actually eliminating things from that? What are some of the things that the founders could or should be doing in those conversations with their early clients?
So I will reference one of my favorite posts on LinkedIn in the last year or so. So the CEO of ClickUp made a post about a month ago, which I reposted myself. And I was reading through it. I didn't know how it, where it was going. And it was phenomenal. Because basically the post says, the post goes, it's a dialogue between his head of product and his CFO. And the conversation is, okay, what should we be exactly your question? What should we build from our backlog? What should we invest in? Oh, but our community needs this and our community needs that. And then as the post goes, at the very end, he reveals that actually this is not a dialogue. This is exactly the thoughts that he's having as a CEO. Like the challenge between building what your community is asking for, building what your customers are asking for, versus what is driving revenue, and versus what you built last year, which was supposed to be the revolutionary feature but drove no pipeline. So the answer is not easy. I would certainly advise anyone listening to this to go and look this this post from the CEO of ClickUp up because I have shared it with all my product teams, my product marketing teams, my sales teams. To bring it down to earth a bit further, it's not easy, and I would say that when you're building your roadmap, you need to start segmenting what you're building for whom and for what purpose. Not everything is going to be for the same purpose. Some features are going to be for increasing adoption. So you have customers, but they're not using your product as much as you wanted or you were hoping. So you're building certain features that you make sure that your customers adopt your existing customers adopt your solution much faster. There are features that make sure that you don't lose customers. So that can be the same with the adoption, but not always. It may mean that, hey, the market has evolved since that customer signed or this set of customers signed up so much that we need to have this other capability that we didn't have before or we haven't thought of. There is a third bucket, which is bringing in customers. Like today, if you're not doing anything agentic or anything with LLMs or anything with Gen AI, you're going to be challenged by your prospect saying, oh, but your competitor has all these other AI functionalities and my CEO is telling me that we need to be in a company. So it's not, I don't think that there is an answer that that fits all. You need to basically segment your roadmap based on what you're trying to achieve. Maybe your vision, maybe your renewals, maybe your adoption, maybe your new customers and so on and so forth. And then prioritize based on the things that again are must have for these objectives. So I know that it sounds kind of like a complicated exercise in the early days, but that will allow you to be very selective on what you do and what you don't do. Because as you rightfully said, it's not about selecting what you're going to do. Like that is the easy part. The tough part is deciding what you're not going to do. And that's where it gets tricky. So cutting from the list is always the hardest thing to do. And the same applies to sales plays. The same applies to go to market. The same applies to marketing investments. If you're going to do a campaign down the road, what do you invest in versus not invest in? So again, it's a matter of what you don't do rather than what you do.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And like you said, it's easier said than done. Because at the end of the day, you know, you're trying to focus really on catering to the needs of your clients and trying to, you know, at the end of the day, try to solve as many problems for them as possible, which naturally probably means, you know, adding or building more solutions or building better capabilities versus actually removing and trying to make something simpler, which brings me to the next point of kind of you touched upon MVP and I hear a lot of different strategies and tools that founders use. One that really stands out is, you know, the tactic of instead of MVP, it's called a SLIC, SLC. So simple, lovable, complete. And It makes sense because, you know, MVP assumes that it's a minimal viable product. So there's bare bones. SLIC basically means it's, you know, very simple and it's lovable by the customer and it's complete. But it's also, again, becomes very challenging for founders to really be able to, without investing too much and without getting the validation from the customer that this is the product that they would love to use. You know, those are the tactics that we spend a lot of time chatting with a lot of founders in those early stages. So I'd be curious to get your thoughts on how did you go about building your version of the MVP when you were building your startup? Or what are some of the things that you're currently seeing as, you know, your company evolved from pre-IPO to now a publicly traded company? Share some thoughts around strategies for the MVP.
So I'm going to play with words a bit, if you allow me. You said that MVP in your mind stands for minimal viable product. For me, it actually stands for minimum viable product. And these are not the same thing. Because sometimes, depending on the market you're going after, your minimum viable product may not be minimal at all. It may be pretty, pretty complete. Because in the words MVP, the most important word is the V. It's not the most important letter is the V. It's not the M, it's not the P. You can do product and you can define what minimum is, but the viability of it is what will actually move you forward. So what ends up happening is, again, very different approach to that based on the stage that you're in. In the beginning, and I tried to be strategic in the previous couple of questions. Now I'm going to be very tactical. Just follow the money. Like in the beginning of your journey, if you have a customer, if you have a set of customers that are willing to do something, just go for it. Don't hold yourself back because you have a different strategy. Just like make your strategy work. If somebody's willing to pay for your service and your offering, just go for it. Make it happen. Worst case, you will not renew them down the road, or worst case, you'll decide that you will go for another customer or another set of customers down the road. But in the beginning, just go for it. This is not the same later, right? And the more you go into your series A, B, C, and especially you're looking at an IPO, you need to have established product market fit, right? We talked about problem solution fit. So in the beginning, problem solution fit, go for whoever is willing to pay for your solution, make it happen. Once you go past that stage, you go to product market fit. Product market fit means, and especially, and it's especially important for VC investments, it means that you have actually identified not only your product, what is your offering, your MVP, or your more advanced MVP, but you have also figured out what's your growth plan. You know that for every dollar of investment that you're going to throw in a certain channel, call it a marketing, call it sales, call it a partnership, call it product, you will get an X percent of return back for every dollar you throw in. And that is very tricky. That's where we think that we have product market fit, then we go to a bigger market and our product market fit is not good enough any longer. We get a new PMF. And eventually, as you grow as a company, you realize that you may actually hit new plateaus that you haven't thought of because the markets are not endless, right? That's why investors usually say that if you don't have a TAM of that starts with a B, usually it's tough because you need many hundreds of millions of TAM, usually actually multiple billions of TAM, so that you can then be flexible to play within the different segments within that bigger TAM. Hence, the concept of continuous iteration based on the feedback you're getting, based on your data, based on the market dynamics, based on competition, it's something that never ends. We are at UiPath today, and we are the clear leaders and winners of RPA, robotic process automation, which was a very up and coming technology at the end of the last decade. We grew through that. Eventually, we became an intelligent automation platform because we started adding automation capabilities to the left and to the right of the core RPA offering we started from. And in the last 18 months, we have become an agentic automation company, because the market dynamics, our customer needs are extending to include agentic AI, agents, robots, agentic workflows, agentic orchestration, things that we would not be talking about 6 or 7 years ago. So that continuous evolution of your own growth, of the market dynamics, of the competitive forces, makes you continuously get into this mentality of pivoting, readjusting, and MVPing capabilities that will help you grow.
To flip the script a little bit, from the point of view of the investor, obviously you have experience as an angel investor and being involved with venture funds and then in the ecosystem of, you know, you teach at a university also, you know, have a direct exposure to founders on ongoing basis. What are some of the latest trends in investing that you're personally very excited about? Obviously, the agentic AI and everything that we've seen in the past couple of years explode from that standard point of view. But you've been in this space for quite some time. You know, your previous startup, you mentioned you were building something in AI in 2012 or 2013. So obviously, you've seen tremendous amount of evolution when it comes to these types of technologies. And currently with UiPath as well, I would imagine you encounter some various insights and trends that you've seen in the market. Share your personal thoughts in terms of what are the different trends and insights that excite you the most these days.
Yeah, in any investment, and this has nothing to do with today's dynamics or yesterday's dynamics or tomorrow's dynamics, there are three elements that most investors invest in, and that includes myself. Again, I wouldn't call myself a professional investor as you are. I just love helping early stage companies when I can. And if that means being able to invest, that's one of the options. But there are three dynamics to identify and evaluate the market from the investor's perspective. There is the team, there is the market, and there is the product. And this is almost like it's like a scale. And the earlier you are, the more you focus on the team. Obviously, the market matters, so you know that at least there is the opportunity to go and build in a bigger market, and the product matters. But the thing is that the team is going to make these decisions. So in the early days, having the right founding team that gives you conviction that they can solve the problem that they are coming to solve. They have a market that is significant, and their early understanding of what the product should be is solid. That's how I would start. The more you move into later stages, the attention shifts because the team almost doesn't matter any longer, in the sense that they've been around for a couple of years. You know what they're going to do. They have actual traction to show you. They have actual product and customers to speak on their behalf. So the market, the focus is shifting. It's shifting to the market. Is the market really good? Is the market growing? Are we addressing the market with product market fit or with problem solution fit? And eventually, the product itself fits. And that's why you will see, unfortunately, and I have to call it out, sometimes you see CEOs and founders being replaced by more seasoned CEOs, because eventually you need someone, now that you have a market figured out and you have a product to address that market, you need someone who can actually go and execute towards that strategy. So as I said, depending on which stage the investment comes, I'm very excited to see, to answer your question even more directly, I am excited to see founding teams being much stronger than every year that goes by. Like when I started thinking about startups were not really a career choice. Like, as I said, 25 years ago, people were not finishing MBAs or finishing their undergrad and saying, I'm going to start a company. They were like, I'm going to go work in investment banking in McKinsey, and startups is this thing that computer scientists do, but nobody understands. The market has evolved. Today, I talk to students, undergrad students, and they're like, yeah, I don't worry about the security of a job. I just want to go out and build my own thing. So you I've seen a very, very, very interesting shift in the quality of the founding teams, irrespective of age, irrespective of experience. They're like strong people actually come with great ideas. So that's a one trend that I love. The second trend that I love is the fact that in the past, distribution was hard. Like, you would build something and how do you distribute it? With the openness of technology today, you can kick off an MVP in a day. You can distribute it globally, almost globally, the next day. And you can try and iterate continuously. So it's phenomenally easier to validate some of your assumptions with your, like, with conversations, with the openness of people, with the product, and with the distribution networks. The third dynamic, and that's going to be my final dynamic, is that there has been a correction in how people invest. Back in the day, investors would spread to a variety of different investments, hoping that something will kick off. What has happened recently, and I would say probably in the last 5 years, is that now investors invest in less ideas, which are a bit more advanced. They had some revenue. They have some revenue traction. They have something that is not just an idea on a PowerPoint, but they invest more. So you get much higher funding rounds at better valuations once you figure out what you're doing. So, and this is eventually, it's a natural selection of which startups are going to make it to the next stage. And it's a natural selection for the investors to make sure that they have higher probability of success so that then they can reinvest back into the next generation.
Also, an ongoing conversation with every founder is the importance of hiring and retaining the best talent. And I always say that for every founder, every CEO, that's always going to be eventually you will become their number one priority, number one job. And it's probably going to be the most difficult aspect of their company. Having run your startup, and from the investor point of view, and also not being part of a large corp, you've seen it from different angles when it comes to attracting, hiring, onboarding, and retaining the best talent. In today's world, it's even more competitive when it comes to finding, you know, just amazing talent. Share some of your strategies that you have seen work well when it comes to this very important aspect of company growth.
Yeah, It is slightly connected to the previous question we were discussing. Startups have become much more straight mainstream. Like in the past, working for a startup, the image of a startup employee is someone playing ping pong all day and wearing shorts and flip flops. And that's not, I mean, we love those employees still to this day. No judgment there. The reality is now people love working for startups way more than in the past. So generally, the talent pool has increased and has improved over the last decade. One of the strategies that I always follow is asking people who do they want to become and what do they want to tell their grandkids when they're sitting in a fireplace and they're 78 years old and they're describing what they did in their careers. Like, try to understand what is the impact you're trying to bring with your work. I believe that the impact of our job has become a much bigger priority than in the past. So giving people this perspective of impact, of innovation, of changing a specific market, changing the entire market, and having a big contribution into this, I believe that that's kind of like the starting point for attracting great talent when you're competing with some of the very high paying jobs out there. The second element is the personality. Not everybody's built to work for a startup, and not every person working for a startup could actually survive in a much bigger organization. So finding the right personalities and bringing them to the right spots is another thing that excites me, and I see founders do all the time. I've seen many, many startups or several startups growing very fast and hoping that and thinking that now that we grew, we're gonna bring these executives from the industry who are gonna take us to the next cycle. And that often fails because at a startup, you are wearing many hats, and the earlier you are, the more hats you wear. And you need to be agile, and you need to be ready to change your role down the road, 6 months, 12 months, whatever that may be for in your case. That's not exactly the same with larger organizations. So finding the right profiles, the right mentality, the right attitude towards change, towards ambiguity, towards chaos, I think that's the second advice I would give, and that's how I go about it. Just to give you a perspective for how I'm hiring, I tell pretty much all my candidates, hey, you're going to join chaos. And chaos is a Greek word, so trust me, I know what it means. But it's an organized chaos, which means that you can thrive if you like chaos, but if you want structure, early stage companies, but even like scale-ups, they are not for you. We are not this big corporation that has all these processes figured out. We don't know exactly what we will be doing in 18 months from now, but certainly we have some of the brightest minds around you, and you should definitely join.
Yeah, those are definitely very insightful strategies that you had shared. And, you know, for you also, you know, in your teaching world as well, as you spend time at, you mentioned NYU, spending a lot of time with the undergrad students and all founders as well, you probably do a lot of research on your own. So I'm curious to hear more about personal, I guess, content diet strategies. What are some of the resources that you consume on a daily basis to keep yourself educated, to keep yourself informed on some of me, and maybe try to stay a little bit ahead of the curve in terms of what are some of the trends that you're expecting or you're very excited about? Share some sources that you love to consume, maybe, and also if there's a book that you always recommend to others, I'd love to get a recommendation as well.
Yeah, so it's, as I said before, my day and my week is pretty loaded. So mm-hmm. I'm going to start with my negatives. I wish I could read more books. I wish I had the time to sit down and enjoy some more books. Hence, I would say that longer form content has been harder for me to consume recently, which means that I find sources that really make sense for the quick periods of breaks that I have to actually do my research. So I'm not an academic, simply said, and I will give one answer, one word to to answer the question, and then I can give you a bit more perspective. The word is curiosity. I'm very curious, and my curiosity gets triggered by multiple sources. I have learned to really love LinkedIn, and this is an advice I'll give to many, many, many folks, including founders, because LinkedIn has become a combination of information, talent, thought leadership, and trend understanding. So for me, I use LinkedIn multiple times a day. But at the same time, I make sure that my LinkedIn feed and my LinkedIn connections are the right ones. I'm not adding anyone. I'm not accepting anyone. But if I see people who have like-minded approach, or they have an opinion that I should follow, I just make sure that I follow them. So certainly, social media is one of the answers. But for me, social media is not TikTok or Instagram, which I also love for other purposes. But it's the professionalism of LinkedIn that has helped me tremendously. The second one, is in-person time, which, you know, during the COVID years became challenging, and then we moved to a lot of remote. So that has really evolved the way that we work. But I do make sure to attend a lot of networking events, dinners, but kind of like closer in closer groups. When you get to talk on a round table with 20 people, it's a million times better than being in a conference of 1,000 people. I'm not saying that conferences are not worthy, because I actually do those as well, but it's exchanging opinions, interacting with people, and making sure that you get an unbiased perspective is what I'm looking to do most. And I'm going to close, because you talked about a book, and I said I'm not, unfortunately, the best expert to that. But there is one that I really love, and I always recommend, and it goes back to the beginning of our conversation on validating customers and understanding what they actually need. It's called Talking to Humans. Success starts with understanding your customers. And this is the book that I always recommend and suggest to founders, to people who are in product development, to people who are in engineering development, even to GTM teams. Because at the end of the day, if you understand what your customers actually need, what they're telling you, then you can build everything. And Henry Ford had said it, if I had asked my customers what they need, they would have told me faster horses. So you don't need to listen exactly what they need, but if you understand their problem, then you can build a car. Because when Henry Ford was asking these questions, he realized that people were looking for faster horses because they needed to go longer distances. And longer distances were not then easy to do on a horse, because it would take time. So yes, he heard people saying we need faster horses, but in reality, what he heard is that we need a transportation means to take us longer distances faster. And that's how he invented the car.
Yannis, you couldn't have closed it any more powerful than this, especially with the quote from Henry Ford on some of the, I guess, mental frameworks that he used. So I really appreciate your time today. I personally learned quite a bit through this conversation. You know, what I love doing with all the guests on the podcast is do a follow-up recording in about a year to see how much have changed, how much have transpired. So I really appreciate your time and being very generous with the information that you shared today.
Absolutely, Zhang. The pleasure was all mine. And, you know, this is such a passion for me that I don't even consider it work. And if we go down the rabbit hole, we could be talking for 5 hours. So thank you for also keeping me within the time limits.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you.